Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have Mexicans made America what it is today? Despite the widespread perception of Latinos as newcomers, there were Hispanics within the land area now claimed by the United States long before Anglo settlers began their expansion into the Southwest and toward the West Coast. All along, my guest will tell us, Mexican Americans have been part of America's evolution, playing roles in the economy, national defense, culture, and ultimately in the fight for full acceptance into the fabric of U.S. society. Neil Foley holds the Robert H. and Nancy Dedman Chair in American History at Southern Methodist University. His new book is called Mexicans in the Making of America. Neil, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So in order to understand the realities of Mexicans in the making of America, we need to take a look at the role of European colonial influence in the making of Mexico. How did the arrival of the Spanish shape the makeup and the social structure of Mexico?
Well, it's a long and complicated story, but
it is NPR.
It's a story of conquest primarily, you know, the fall of Tenochtitlan in 1519, and the origins of Mexico lie in the northward expansion of this colonial enterprise of Spaniards, Indians, and mestizos, or mixed-race Indian, Spanish, and African slaves that were imported in the 16th and 17th century. And so this northward expansion of what was called New Spain and later Mexico when it achieved independence basically began to establish cities in what we now call the Southwest, the American West, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Santa Fe, Tucson, El Paso, etc. And it wasn't until the 1820s that the late arriving Anglo-Americans arrived. And, of course, they arrived with a different racial regimen, that is, black people and white people. And what they found in Latin America, at the northern face of Latin America, which was then Mexico, was that people weren't black or white. They were Mexicanos, who were a mixed race group of people or nationality, who, particularly after the Mexican Revolution of 1910, ceased to think of themselves in terms of Spanish or Indians or mestizos, but simply as Mexicans. And so that's perhaps one of the most complicated histories, is the way in which the Latin Americans developed different ways of identifying themselves ethno-racially than Americans, which basically decided that from the earliest years that there were Indians and there were slaves and there were free white people, mostly from Europe.
So the ability to classify human beings, which most people would argue was not necessarily a great thing to do, but it became more complicated when Anglo settlers came down and encountered Mexicans.
Yes, because Mexicans are sort of betwixt and between these polarities of black and white. And so the question began to percolate historically, beginning in Texas, where the Anglos first crossed the Sabine River. So, and particularly after their defection from Mexico in 1836. So where do they fit? Are they going to be given full citizenship rights? They're not African Americans. They're not slaves. This was before the Civil War. But they are a conquered people, and they're not white, which meant something, and certainly in the 19th century, they used the expression that they were mixed breed or mongrelized people, whose Indian blood made them inferior to Europeans, and that pretty much explains, again in broad historical strokes, the subordination of Mexican peoples throughout the Southwest after. Basically, the Southwest became part of the United States after the war with Mexico in 1848.
The point's been made many times that for many Mexicans or Mexican Americans, they never did cross the border. The border, as the expression goes, crossed them.
Well, that's true. It's just it's almost a cliche in Chicano or Mexican American history, and in part, what it suggests is that this is our homeland. This is the place where. I mean, Mexicans are, in my view, not everybody will agree with this, but we're basically detribalized Indians. So we are native to North America. I mean, 200,000 Spaniards did not turn 25 million natives into, you know, Europeans. So, you know, I'm not going to, you know, get into sort of the DNA qualities of peoples, but we are indigenous to North America, and it's difficult to have been in this part of the world for generations and generations and to be thought of immigrants or new, especially newly arrived immigrants. It'd be the equivalent of talking about the Irish or the Germans as recent immigrants, or the Japanese and the Chinese in California particularly as recent immigrants. Mexican immigration is a fact. There's no question about that, especially in the last 25 years when we've seen unprecedented immigration from Mexico and other parts of the world. But that doesn't mean that this is Mexicans in the United States is a new phenomenon. They were here from the start in this particular part of the world where we're speaking from.
Why did that history not get looped into the sort of classic traditional American history textbooks? Why was it all concentrated in the northeastern part of the United States?
You know, that's the question that so many historians wonder and try to correct. It's an East Coast centric history. You know, it begins with the Pilgrims and Puritans, mm-hmm. and you know, Plymouth Rock and so forth, and it's westward moving. You know, it's westward expansion, and so we. Kentucky is not on the map until the Anglo-Americans get there. And Texas is not on the map because, first of all, Texas is a province of Mexico. So who cares about this province of Mexico until Moses Austin and his son Stephen cross the Sabine River between Louisiana and Texas and arrive in the 1820s? Then all of a sudden, everybody's saying Texas. And people are going to Texas, hence gone to Texas. And so forth and so on. The gold rush, you know, in 1849, just 1 year after California was taken from Mexico in the 1848 war. So you have these populations of Anglo-Americans westering, and the history goes with them. It's written from their perspective. But if you place yourself in the present-day American West, whether you're Native American or Mexican-American, what you're witnessing is this westering juggernaut of Anglo-Americans settling and conquering this part of the world. And that is the story, basically, of the American West since the early 19th century. Yeah, and consider the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the United States in a very short period of time. So Anglo-Americans in this part of the world is a recent phenomenon in the history of North America.
You make the point that the history of Mexicans in America is shaped very much by the history of the relationship between the United States and Mexico. And there was this giant land acquisition that happened in 1848. Can you talk about why, given the fact that, Mexico has long been this huge and reliable trade partner, and it's a nation that we've had considerable influence over, some would say, many would say undue influence, why do some Americans find the presence of Mexicans threatening?
Right. First of all, Americans have found the presence of Mexicans threatening long before the last two decades of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st century. Part of it has to do with the idea that they take our jobs, right? The economics of it, you know, they're competitors. But I've always felt that in many ways it's a lot deeper than that. It's this sense that they're going to change us rather than us change them, which is what we do as Americans. And I'm now speaking as a U.S.-born Mexican-American who, you know, believes that people come to this country and they adapt and they assimilate in various ways so that by the second generation, the U.S.-born children grow up speaking English and finding that they have cultural ties to people from other different ethno-national backgrounds. But because so many Mexicans have been part of a migrant stream that really has only ebbed and flowed but never stopped since 1848, there's this constant presence of the Spanish language everywhere in the Southwest. And when those immigrants stop settling just in the border states and a few other states of the American West, but start moving out into the New South, right, the deep southern states like Alabama and Georgia and Arkansas and North Carolina that have experienced really rapid growth in their Hispanic populations just in the last 20 years, people then start to feel uncomfortable, like, what are they doing here? Even though they're not really taking anybody's jobs, these are jobs that nobody really wants to do. I mean, few Americans really want to, you know, work in the tobacco fields or on agribusiness farms and so the low-skilled jobs in construction. So there's this concern that where is it all going to end? Well, rather than asking where it all began, which is this is not a new phenomenon. And the children of these immigrants grow up to be people like me, just, you know, Americans of Mexican origin. And pretty much by the third generation, they're not even speaking any Spanish anymore.
Well, so many times in this country when we talk about immigration, we debate over immigration. Sometimes there is a distinction made between legal and illegal, documented and undocumented immigrants. But I wonder if that's sort of a code for acculturated and unacculturated or less acculturated immigrants.
Well, it is and it isn't, I suppose. I mean, a code, I mean, it's technically correct that there are, you know, 11 million plus undocumented immigrants living in the country. But I would say that the code is not just about the immigrants who are here illegally as being unacculturated and unassimilated. It's worse than that. It's that they're demonized to be, you know, criminals and disease carriers, people who are, for whatever reasons, incapable of actually becoming constructive and productive members of American society, and therefore hasten the decline of America. And so the people who are calling themselves patriots, who rush to the border like the Minutemen to prevent this invasion, feel like they're defending America against this Trojan horse that's coming into the country and is going to cause its decline. That's what the code is really about. It's not just that they're not assimilating, that they're not the kind of people that you want to assimilate. And that's a fairly disturbing thought.
We're speaking this hour with Neil Foley, who is Robert H. and Nancy Dedman Chair in American History at Southern Methodist University. His new book is called Mexicans in the Making of America. If you'd like to be part of a conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Neil Foley, who is Robert H. and Nancy Dedman Chair in American History at Southern Methodist University and author of the new book, Mexicans in the Making of America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Neil, how did Mexicans move back and forth across the border before it was in any way secured? And at what point did Mexican citizenship become a barrier to entry?
That's a question that historians have been talking about for a long time now. My own grandparents came up to the United States from Mexico, from Chihuahua, Mexico, before there were any immigration laws on the books for that, which the first one was in 1917, which just required a head tax and a literacy test to make sure that people could read and write in any language at the sixth grade level. Even after 1917, and certainly throughout World War II, up to World War II, very few people had any difficulty crossing that 2,000-mile border, mainly because they were being recruited to come to this country to work in the railroads and agribusiness farms and mining. It was never really considered an immigration problem. It was more like transnational labor migration, and it was back and forth. You know, people went back to their families. They didn't come across the border and then stay here without ever going back. You know, the first really big reaction that Americans had to Mexicans in this country happened in the early 1950s with this quasi-military roundup called Operation Wetback, which was authorized by President Eisenhower in the aftermath of World War II to deport Mexicans who overstayed their contracts in the so-called Bracero program. So let me back up for a second and say that during World War II, when we were at total war with Germany and the forces of Japan, and we needed all the able-bodied men and women to fight this war. So we had women going into the workforce, you know, as Rosie the Riveters in our defense factories. African-Americans found themselves not only serving in the armed forces, but also in the industry. Who was going to pick our crops? Who was going to provide the agricultural labor if Americans were off at war? And so the United States and Mexico signed a bilateral agreement that we call now the Bracero Program. Bracero simply means a manual laborer. And they came up by the tens of thousands to work in the agricultural industry. They were welcomed. In fact, they weren't treated very well in the towns where they would try to go and shop and eat in cafes. But they were certainly welcomed by agribusiness because they would have not been able to do the jobs that they were supposed to do. These were not visas. These were six-month contracts that expired. Then they were renewed. In fact, the United States liked the program so much, and certainly agribusiness loved it so much, that after the war, it was an emergency wartime effort, they decided to extend the program with Mexico's agreement, and they kept extending it until 1964. You know, this is quite a time after World War II. And what happened, of course, is a lot of those Mexican Bracero workers decided to stay and to raise families here. And that's why a decade before the program ended in 1954, there was this massive sweep to round up between 500,000 and a million former braceros and braceros who had overstayed their contracts and deport them. And the next big sort of backlash against Mexicans in the Southwest was in California in the early 1990s. With Proposition 187 to deny social services and public education and medical services, except emergency care, to anybody who did not have proof of their legal status in the United States. Turned out that law was unconstitutional and was never enacted. And then, of course, the third big wave of anti-immigrant sentiment came after 9/11. When we felt like we needed to secure our southern border as a defense, a national security defense against possible terrorism. So there have been throughout history waves of anxiety and fear about Mexicans because we share a 2,000-mile land border with them. So it's very different than other parts of the world where people don't live so close together and share a common history, because that border for many Mexicans divides a region that used to be part of Mexico. And it's not like they're coming up saying, well, this is my homeland. They're coming up here for the same reason that immigrants throughout the last 200 years of American history have been coming to this country, and that's to seek economic opportunity that they don't have at home. And for some, religious freedom, political freedoms. And I think history shows that all of these immigrants, not just Mexicans who come here, by the second and third generation, they are bona fide Americans, and nobody's telling them to go home anymore. It's always the first generation immigrants that receive the brunt of the anti-immigrant animus that surfaces periodically in our history.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Gerardo in Allen. Hi, Gerardo.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Well, I was just telling the person who answered, Latinos are seen by a lot of the press as a monolithic block, and the fact that that translates to a lot of stories about just because somebody has a Spanish surname, it's automatically thought that Latinos are going to vote for that person. And so I think that relates back to this whole subject, because one of the common experiences of a lot of Mexican-Americans, a lot of people who come here, is that we're not distinguished between generation or what have you. So we all feel that discrimination. So I think the fact that a lot of people, even second or third generation, support, say, the new immigrant, is because we get treated the same way.
What do you think about that, Neil?
Well, I have no argument with that at all. I mean, I think he raises a very, very interesting point, which is that the animus towards Mexicans is not just related to the immigrant generation. It goes beyond that. I mean, I think if there are Mexican Americans listening now, I'm sure that a number of them have experienced Anglo-American saying things like, Genio, you don't even seem like a Mexican to me. It's a backhanded compliment, like saying, well, you speak English so well and you're so well educated. It's like their whole concept of a Mexican is not an assimilated person, and or someone who would not think to just vote automatically for someone with a Latino surname, or would not think that even Latinos like myself don't have Hispanic surnames, right? That, you know, we, like everybody else, we marry outside of our ethno-racial groups. We have our own political orientations. And as this caller puts it, and we are not a monolithic group. What group is? You know, non-Hispanic whites are not monolithic. African Americans are not monolithic. Why should we be monolithic? In fact, we are one of the most diverse groups lassoed together under the rubric of Latino or Hispanic, which is an artificial pan-ethnic identity that was created, constructed, invented during the Nixon administration and put into the census in 1980. For the first time, there was no such thing before 1980 as Hispanic or Latino. You were either Cuban or Puerto Rican or Mexican. Those were the big three groups. Now we're all Latinos. We're all Hispanics. It's like you can come from Paraguay or Uruguay or Peru or the Dominican Republic. Minute you cross the border into the United States, you lose those identities and you become Hispanic or Latino. And then all of the various ways that non-Hispanics look at Hispanics then start to operate. They're all Catholic. They're all recent immigrants. All the monolithic kinds of thinking that the caller has suggested start to take place, and they affect second and third and fourth and fifth generation Latinos and Mexican Americans. So yes, I find it very interesting being an assimilated, acculturated American of Mexican ancestry. Feeling the sense that that we're not really bona fide Americans, that we're sort of recent, we're newcomers here. And it's simply not true.
What kind of expectations were there for Mexican immigrant men of draft age during the times that military drafts were active in this country?
Well, you know, with the passage of the Selective Service Act, so-called draft, 1940, everybody who was at that time 21 years of age, it was lowered to 18, regardless of whether you were an immigrant or not, had to go into the Army if you were drafted. If you were a member of a co-belligerent nation, that means if you were a member of a neutral nation, say like Switzerland, you would not be drafted. But as soon as Mexico declared war on the Axis powers, then any Mexican immigrant in the United States was subject to the draft. And so I write in the book about all of the Mexican immigrants who fought in the war and, you know, received GI benefits, accelerated path to citizenship afterwards and so forth, along with, 500,000 to 1 million Mexican Americans and Puerto Rican Americans and Cuban Americans and other Latinos and Hispanics. This was part of a growing close relationship between the United States and Mexico that I argue began with World War II, that our relationship had between the United States and Mexico had always been a little bit tentative and mutually suspicious. Mexico still not happy about what happened in 1848 with half of its land taken by war. The United States feeling like Mexico was anti-American, which to a certain extent it was. World War II changed all that. Mexico became a very important ally to the United States in providing natural resources, zinc, copper, and other minerals that that the United States needed to prosecute the war. And, of course, the so-called soldiers in the field, the bracero workers. In fact, in one of the ironies, I think, of history, especially from this standpoint in 2014, is that the states like Arizona that passed one of the most draconian sort of anti-immigrant laws, SB 1070, requiring people to carry identification to prove that they're in this country legally. States like Arizona and New Mexico and Texas and California, their state legislatures after World War II passed resolutions praising Mexico and all the immigrants who fought in the war and worked in the defense industries and picked the crops and helped America win the war. And they said, we are going to start celebrating Cinco de Mayo and the 16 de septiembre, or September 16th. That's why we have those holidays, because the United States recognized that we should celebrate Mexico's liberation holidays as well, their founding holidays, because they were so important to us during World War II. And, of course, as soon as the Bracero program ended in 1964, we immediately started up with this border industrial initiative, which established these maquiladoras on the border.
Those are the twin plants, the factories.
Yes, exactly. And that, of course, and then in 1994, we have the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, that could not have happened if there was all this tension and all these problems with Mexico. I would say that the passage of the Secure Border Fence in 2006, which authorized the construction of a 700-mile border, was a strain on that relationship, but because it was unilateral and wasn't done in consultation with Mexico. But Mexico understands, too, that this is a sop to the political right in America that demands that the border be secured. But, Janet Reno said it, and certainly a number of Mexicans have said the same thing, a version of the same thing. Show me a, 50-foot wall, and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. The point being that it's not going to really stop immigration and migration that's been going on for over 150 years. But it's what has to be done politically. And it, the point being, it did not undermine U.S.-Mexico relations.
So along the border, you have California, Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico on the U.S. side. What accounts for the different reaction we've seen in recent years to immigration issues, to so-called border security issues of a state like Arizona from what we've seen in Texas?
Well, you know, Arizona, of the four border states, has had the smaller percentage of Latinos until recently, and it's been growing so rapidly that those the kind of fear that rapid demographic change usually induces in, you know, Americans in other parts of the country as well, and one could say even globally. It's like, what's happening to our state, right? Within 20 years, Arizona is facing what just happened to California this year, where non-Hispanic whites, for the first time in the history of the states, are not the largest group. 39% of the state of California is Hispanic, and 38% is non-Hispanic white. That puts California in the same category as Hawaii as having non-Hispanic whites as a minority group. Okay, so Texas, it's going to happen in Texas. It's going to happen in Arizona. And Texans are more comfortable with it because we already have 38% of our population is Latino. All right, 45% of our population in Texas is non-Hispanic white. So they're closing in on each other. But I think because the population of non-Hispanic whites has never been, you know, in the, at least in the second half of the 20th century, significantly larger than the Latino population. Most Texans pretty much have a history of, started off rocky, obviously, in 1836, you know, the Alamo and all of that. But, you know, they're pretty much accustomed to Mexicans in their midst, unlike in Arizona. And where they were mostly located in Tucson and Nogales, you know. And as former President George Bush once said, you know, we don't bash immigrants in this state. He said that at the very same time in California when they were bashing immigrants.
Let me jump in here. My guest is Neil Foley. We're talking about his new book, Mexicans in the Making of America. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Neil Foley of SMU about his new book, Mexicans in the Making of America. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You make the point in the book, Neil, that you know, any kind of cultural change really is a two-way street. I just want to talk to you about something that, wasn't specifically in the book, but there's been a lot of interesting stuff written over the past few weeks about this traditional Mexican holiday, Dia de los Muertos, which Americans have sort of seen and grabbed little bits of and not fully understood. And there are a lot of people of Mexican heritage in particular who are concerned that this thing that is not the same as Halloween has been misunderstood. And I wonder about what you might be able to tell us about anxiety within Mexico and in the United States within pockets of Mexican culture about concerns that the richness of some of that culture is being diluted by the presence of sort of American cultural hegemony.
Right. I think that there has always, in the 20th century, throughout the entire 20th century, there has always been a concern in Mexico of the Americanization, particularly of the six northern states of Mexico, from Sonora to, you know, Brownsville and just basically the northern tier of states.
And they're unquestionably different from the southern Mexican states.
Well, and they're unquestionably different from each other. Mm-hmm. You know, there's great diversity there. And culturally, you know, there's some divisions, I should say. It's a delicate topic between Mexicans from central Mexico who view norteños, as they call the northerners, as arrogantes and presumidos, you know, sort of.
I think we all understand the cognates, even if
people
don't
exactly.
speak Spanish.
Yes, exactly. And then the northerners, you know, I say some of the folks from Monterrey, you know, sort of industrial and entrepreneurial thinking of central Mexicans is not quite as energetic. You can see this in all cultures, right? I mean, I lived in Spain and, you know, the people from Barcelona, the Catalans thought of themselves as just, a little bit more wealthy and industrially competent than other parts of that region, of that nation. So this is not new. But what interests me about this is one of the Mexican intellectuals at the beginning of the century, in the 1920s, I should say, of the last century, he wrote about the barbarous process of apochamiento, which is a Spanish word which means basically the gringoization of Mexican culture in the north. And he was concerned precisely about the idea that, you know, instead of celebrating El Día de los Reyes, which is January 6th, their kind of their Christmas, instead doing Santa Claus on the 25th and the 24th, and instead of doing, you know, Día de los Muertos, which was a religious kind of holiday in a way, All Souls Day, then became trick-or-treating and Halloween. All of these things are part of this two-way exchange of culture. People talk about the Latinization of America, but I would also talk about the Americanization of Mexico. For example, 30, 40 years ago, you could get people from Guatemala and Mexico coming to the United States who've never seen skyscrapers and never seen, you know, airplanes and so forth. I mean, that can't happen anymore. I mean, even the poorest of the poor have televisions. They're not flat screens, but you can get a television set, you know, for $35, you know, one of those CRTs, that huge things that we used to have in this country 20, 30 years ago. And they watch television and they learn a little bit about American culture before they even arrive here. Basically, what I'm saying is the forces of globalization have changed this idea that, you know, people come to a country and they're like complete strangers in a strange land. Yeah. Well, they may be strangers, but the land isn't all that strange to them because they've learned a lot about it through the global forces of technology and the media before they've even gotten here.
Even branding, things like you can find Walmart in a lot of Mexican cities.
Not just Walmart. You've got Costco's, you've got Sam's, you've got McDonald's, of course, you know, led the way, you know, decades ago. You've got all of the big brands everywhere. There's a Walmart, you know, within stone's throw of the pyramids in some places in Mexico. So it's not like they don't have access to American culture. And I mean, I guess the question now is the American culture anyway, or is this just global culture? It actually in many ways brings Mexicans and Americans into a common matrix, at least in a consumer a way, that when you cross the border in either direction, you're still shopping in the same shops and, you know, eating a Domino's pizza or whatever it is. These chains are all over Mexico and the United States.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Eric in Plano. Hi, Eric. If your radio's on, turn it off, okay?
Hello?
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thanks. I just wanted to represent my point of view, which sounded a little bit different from earlier you were discussing immigration and voter ID, but there's a lot of people, I mean, at least I feel this way, and I think there are other people that feel the same way, that have absolutely no issues with another culture, totally comfortable with Mexicans or any other culture, no fear, but at the same time just want to, any immigration from any country, that they need to follow the established rules and come here legally. And so it's I just think that someone supporting those laws doesn't necessarily feel a fear or demonize someone from another country.
Do you want to comment on that, Neil? And by the way, I don't think we were talking in this conversation about voter ID, just to clarify. But thanks for your call, Eric. I appreciate it.
There's no question that we have laws on the books about, you know, how you come to this country with visas and so forth. And the problem with the deeper problem of the whole question of immigration reform has to do with those very laws, okay? Because, you know, if you have 11 to 12 million undocumented people in this country, not all of them obviously from Mexico, but certainly over half of them from Mexico, you have a problem. And if you look at some of the – what those problems are, some of them are pretty sad. You have, for example, about a million of those people who were brought here as children by their parents. They call themselves the Dreamers, and this is because they're trying to get the Dream Act passed, which would give them a path to citizenship since they did not come across the border unlawfully. They were brought here by their parents. Many of them have never even been to their countries of origin. They, in fact, many of them thought that they were American citizens, born and raised here, until they tried to get a Social Security card or a driver's license and realized that they were not U.S. citizens. I have met some of those students at Southern Methodist University at SMU, where I teach, who have come up to me after class and told me that they were Dreamers and expressed the fear that they have that ICE or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the police, could come at any hour of the day or the night to their house, to their dorms, and put them in a bus and deport them to a country that they've never been to. Okay, we're talking about laws on the books that require deportation of people who are not here lawfully. And that means knocking on the door of a house, coming in, and taking the parents who are here unlawfully because they overstayed their visas, which is the majority of the cases of unlawful residents here, and deporting them even though they have three children in the house who are U.S. born and American citizens. What happens to those children? They become orphans. They are put in foster care. All right, so we are a nation that creates orphans by deporting the parents. These are issues that are not just about the law. These are issues that are about ethics and morals. We have broken up families. We have separated siblings from siblings and mothers and fathers from their children and children from their mothers and fathers, all in the name of you came here without the proper paperwork. You know, I was and, you know, the idea of putting people in detention centers, we sometimes see roundups where people are handcuffed and put on buses and taken to detention centers. My daughter was in Mexico with me, and she was studying. I was doing research, and her visa expired. And she was caught with an expired visa. They did not put her in an orange jumpsuit or handcuff her and send her to a detention center awaiting deportation. They said, you're here. Your visa's expired. That's a civil offense, as it is in this country. And you need to pay a fine and renew your visa. So she had to pay a couple $100 fine, which hurt. She was only 18 at the time, and that was that. Well, we're not a country that is handling these issues in a way that doesn't hurt families, and that is a concern to me.
How did the history of the Chicano movement and labor advocacy and even things advocacy for things like veterans' rights affect the way that Mexicans were perceived within the broader U.S. culture?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Is it the fact that they were veterans? How does that?
Well, was there not an effort to make sure that returning veterans of Mexican descent received all the benefits of the GI Bill and that sort of thing?
Yes. Oh, I see what you're saying. They depended on their citizenship status. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting point. If they fought in World War II, just as an example, well, if you're a Mexican American, of course you're entitled to, you know, the benefits of the GI Bill, not just for education, tuition, but also for low interest mortgages to purchase houses and so forth. The issue there was, what happened to the immigrants, Mexican immigrants, who were drafted into the U.S. Army? And when they came out, many of them with medals of honor, in fact, most historians will point out that Mexican descent soldiers in World War II earned more medals of honor than any other group in proportion to their percentage in the population. So they joined in great numbers and fought bravely and so forth, as did other groups. But when they came back, even though their immigration status as being in the country in some cases unlawfully in the 1940s didn't prevent the draft boards from putting them into uniform and sending them to the front, which they willingly did. But when they came home, rather than giving them honorable discharges and putting them on the fast track to citizenship, which was the promise made to them, they started to deport them as saying they were here illegally, and should never have been in uniform in the first place. And it was the American people who heard about this that said, this is not right, and to stop doing this. And so the country stopped deporting those Mexican immigrants who served in the war, and instead started to praise them and gave them fast tracks to citizenship and rights to the GI Bill. I think that fighting in I would say immigrants who wear the uniform of the United States have traditionally, and I'm talking about going all the way back to the Revolutionary War, have always had this sense that, you know, these people have earned their citizenship, have proven their loyalty to this country. And that's why so many Mexican Americans have chosen to be in the armed services as a way of expressing their Americanness, of getting the bona fides that they are, true Americans and not immigrants and not marginal people who don't fight for their country or somehow don't have the same kind of love and loyalty for the United States that non-Hispanic whites and others have.
Neil Foley is Robert H. and Nancy Dedman Chair in American History at Southern Methodist University. His new book is called Mexicans in the Making of America. Neil, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.